to MotoPod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 622. I'm Jim McDowell. With me is Derek Cabrera to cover the action not only from Thailand, but also Japan. So you get a two-for-one deal this evening. Derek, how's it going?
I'm doing very good. We're breaking up the flyaways here. It's a little bit easier for us here in the States because all time zones are out of whack, and then trying to meet up for races so close together seemed a little bit silly. So we're breaking up the flyaways for both us and you, the listeners, and should be pretty good. We got some decent racing to talk about. We got some big events in the MotoGP championship, and we also have your fair share of rumors and news topics. But before that, I would like to say a big thank you to Joshua Tattel, Keith Kovac, Nick Saban, and Scott Saunter for your donations. They are incredibly appreciated. They help the show go round. We get doing what we are doing right now because of that. So thank you very much. If you want to donate right now, you can go to motopodcast.com. You can go to patreon.com/motopod. Any little bit helps. And with that out of the way, we can get on to the news. Jim, do you want to start us off?
Sure. We'll start with the news here. So one of the Onchu twins is going to the Moto3 Tech 3 team next year. We don't know which one it is as of right now, but it seems logical that Denise would go there and Chan would stay with the IO team. However, that has not been confirmed.
Yeah, there's a lot of Chan Anju is going to Supersport. That's what all the talk's been about. It seems like he hasn't really gotten along with the IO system.
Wow, Supersport. That's
which makes sense, right? I mean, Keenan is their manager. You know, he has a lot of pull in the Supersport paddock, so maybe he can get a different ride. I don't know, but that's what I heard. But it seems like Dennis in the wild card appearances he's had has done pretty well. So I don't know if he'd stay with the IO team. I don't know if he'd go to Tech 3. I think both are certainly an option. But yeah, from what I heard Chan was going to Supersport. So we'll have to keep an eye out for that one.
That's wild. I would have thought for sure, you know, given Chan's success that he had early on, that he would stay in the GP paddock and not go to World Superbike. But I see the connection. I get the connection. That's just interesting.
Yeah, it seems interesting, especially it seems like the brothers are pretty close too. So I'd be surprised if they are in different paddocks. But, you know, if they feel like they have a better opportunity somewhere else, and again, they got Keenan and he's World Superbike paddock legend. If you have that guy and that backing with all that he comes with behind you, it's tough to say no in regardless of what paddock it's in, I guess. But we got some news about Romano Fanati. We've been trying to figure out exactly where he's gonna go, because it seemed like all those Moto 2 rides got sucked up. But he will be on the Max Biaggi racing team for next year, which it could be a pretty interesting team. They got a lot of emotion in that team, seems like. And it's worth noting, Alonso Lopez will also be in that team too, I believe. So it's going to be a two rider team, and it's going to be emotional. It's going to be Italian.
Yeah, there will be some hand waving, that's for sure. I want to see what's going to happen. I just think that it's not a match made in heaven, in my opinion, but I do think that the two of them together is going to cause something to happen. I just don't know if it's a good something or a bad something, but something's going to happen.
I think that's fair. I mean, either Yeah, it's either going to go one or two ways. It's not going to be like a middle of the road season, because Fanati has to win the championship next year. He has to be a true title contender next year on that bike, between his age, experience, and the package that he's on, which has shown capable to fight for the championship. So yeah, it's gonna be an interesting year next year with that project.
Yep. Carrying on with the news, Arbolino had a problem during the Tiger Grand Prix where he kind of ran off the track. He took his right hand and loosened his glove, and looked like he had some problem with his glove, and then got back to racing again. We found out in Japan that his right hand went numb during the race. That's not good to have a hand, especially your throttle hand and the hand that controls the brakes, to go numb on you during a race. I have not seen a reason for the cause of this yet, but I gotta think that it's a pinched nerve, or maybe it's in an extreme case of carpal tunnel syndrome. You could also get some numbing going on there, but that doesn't sound too good for him.
Yeah, I was actually just watching the highlights of the race back, and I saw that hand. I kind of forgot about it, but yeah, I mean, that's a pretty big talking point of that race. But yeah, definitely an odd one. Moving on, we have Jeremy Alcoba, who is confirmed at the Gresini Moto 3 team next year. He's done a couple wild cards. Yeah, or is he in the championship full time? Did I just eat that? Did I just screw that up?
No, I don't think so. I
believe he's done a couple wild cards.
If he did, I don't remember him doing them. I guess I don't really. I should probably pay more attention to the goings on in Moto 3, but I don't for some reason. You know, it's a lot of different names and faces and places, and they're all going different ways. So yeah, I think you're right. I think he maybe had a couple of wild carding a couple of times with Gresini. I think now he's got the ride next year with Garcia, I think, on the Australia Galassi team. So he'll be someone to watch, because he was
okay. Yeah, yeah. He's done a couple wild cards. He's in the CEV this year. The power of the internet is great. Yeah, so it seems like it makes sense, because I've heard the name before, and every now and then I'll watch the CEV races that they post online free to YouTube. I generally try to save them for the winter when I'm dying for racing. So that's a good one to check out if you guys haven't. But yeah, so that should be an interesting signing. You know, Gresini we know it's a championship winning bike. Unfortunately, Rodrigo has had a terrible year of luck on that bike. We know he's a fast rider and just hasn't panned out this year. So hopefully he can do a bit better next year, and Alcoba can get a good start as well.
Yep. So a little bit of sad news for American race fans. Joe Roberts appears to be out of a job in the Moto 2 class, and it seems like he's not even going to be around in the Moto GP paddock at all.
Where did you hear this said rumorness, Jim?
That was said during the Moto 2 qualifying at Motegi, I believe. Yes. During Moto 2 qualifying, they said that it appeared he was out of a job and at the team.
Did the commentators say that, or yes. did they have an interview with the
No, it was just the commentators.
Okay, because from what I can tell, he still has that seat next year.
Really?
Yeah, it seemed like from Joe's comments on social media, between him congratulating, I believe it's Arenas that has the seat next to him. If they stay in Moto 2 next year, Arenas is going into that team. He was like, great to have you on the team for next year. And then news that's not on here, which is Moto America news, is Rocco Landers, the junior 300 winner for Moto America this year, got selected for Red Bull Rookies a couple days ago. And Joe said, you know, excited to see you in the paddock next year. So by those comments, sounds like Joe Roberts hasn't been told he doesn't have a ride, so, but it could just be him being optimistic. I don't know.
I think this is a stay tuned moment and let's see where this pans out. It's something to keep an eye on because there's obviously two different thought processes going on right now. There's a rumor that he's not there, and there's him saying that he's going to be next year. So I think it's a stay tuned moment. I'll give you a bonus American. What's his name in Moto America?
Garrett Gerloff will be joining the GRT
World Superbike team. Wow.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys. That's a tongue twister and a half for me. So good grief.
Yeah. That's going to be great to see him there next year. He's going to be with Kerkasulo. He's on a competitive package. We've seen this year with Melandri and Cortese. And, you know, there's a big transition that he's got. There's a couple great interviews out with him between print and interviews that he's done. You know, just kind of going over all the challenges with him. Not just going to a new championship, new tracks, but he seems like he's going to be moving to Italy. You know, everything that comes along with an American or a non-European going to race in the world stage, you know, you kind of need to uproot your life. So going to be interesting to see that develop, because World Superbikes is done this weekend and then starts up again in February. So it's a pretty short turnaround, for someone trying to join the team. So, but yeah, so we're not, America isn't totally out of world championship, runnings. And as I said, Rocco Landers, 14, going to be 15 next year, just got selected for the, Red Bull rookies. So, he'll be doing that as well. So that's going to be good to see. And yes, anyway, off the America train and on to the Italian train, I guess. Next thing we have here is Bezzecchi getting sick in his helmet, which I guess is part of the tie round, but it's always terrible to hear when a rider gets sick in their helmet. I remember at one point Ben Spies did a race and he was doing that in his helmet. Anyways, pretty gross, but Bezzecchi didn't have greatest of 2 weeks, and that can be a danger doing the flyaways, you know, like you're eating different countries' food, your stomach can not do too well with the change in diet, with the change in even the water, you know.
Sure.
So that's unfortunate, but happened a couple times. Always something to watch out for. I feel like people always get like food poisoning and they'll go like around a whole team, right? Because they'll always be out for the night together. So we still got a couple flyaways left. I feel like it happens a little less in Phillip Island, but Sepang's coming too, which is again a different culture for the whole paddock. So just something to keep an eye on. Moving on, we got huge news. This is a big one, is that Nakagami will sit out the remainder of the season to get shoulder surgery done. Apparently, he's had pretty bad issues, which he's kept totally quiet to the whole paddock, and he's going to need to get surgery done. It's going to be a six-month recovery, basically the same surgery Mark has had, except he's not superhuman, so he can't just recover. And that opens the door for a Mr. Johan Zarco to replace Nakagami for the last three races. So we got Phillip Island, Sepang, and Valencia, which I think, Jim, me and you kind of share the same opinion here, that Zarco's probably going to have a pretty rough time with that.
I think he will. If he didn't like the KTM, I can't see him liking the Honda. I just don't see that at all. I thought Matt Oxley had the best tweet. He had a picture of Zarco when he ran up the backside of Marquez's bike from Phillip Island, 2 years ago when he was on the Tech 3 team?
Last year
on the Tech 3 team. And I'm like, that's cheeky, Matt. But I did like it. It's something that will be very interesting to watch, because I think Zarco stands a better chance of being faster on the Honda than Lorenzo, even if Lorenzo was completely healthy. And he's not.
Well, they're going to be on two different bikes as well. And apparently, as we've seen with Cal and Nakagami, that 2018 bike is a little bit easier to ride because it doesn't have the extra horsepower, and it still has the front end stability that it was kind of so that, you know, that was its strong point, seemingly. But we know that's not Zarco's thing. He needs corner speed. He is a rider molded out of Lorenzo's data. So yeah, but at the same time, Lorenzo on the Valencia test, he wasn't super slow. He wasn't as slow as he's been this whole year. So I think if he's going to get on any Honda, he's getting on the right Honda. Again, we don't know if it's an audition for him to take Jorge's seat at the end of the year. As of now, all the noise coming out of Honda is saying, no, we're going to keep Lorenzo. He doesn't. He has a two-year contract. He's staying here. But I feel like anyone's kind of dumb to listen to that at this point with all the moves going on the way they're going on. I don't think Zarco's going to turn down a offer from Yamaha to do three races for no payoff, just for three races, you know? I think he has an understanding that this can be an audition for next year, because he knew at the time of him taking the ride for these last three races that Yamaha door was going to close if he took it. So he has to know that this could be an audition for something. So yeah, interesting. I think it's going to be tough. I'm excited to see him on the bike. I hope he proves me wrong, but it's an interesting one.
I think there's no way Zarco goes back to Yamaha after this, because I don't think Honda's going to let that happen.
Yeah, I think...
You know, I think that, like, why are you going to put Zarco on a bike for three races and have him take information and go back to Yamaha with it? I can't see that happening.
Well, I don't think Yamaha's going to have him. The only thing I can logically think...
Well, I thought Yamaha was going to take Zarco back as a test rider and let him ride and develop the bike.
Yeah, that was the plan.
That was a plan. Now, I think since he's got on a Honda, I don't think it's going to happen.
No. They said if he signs the contract for these three races for LCR, Yamaha told him explicitly that then you are not the test rider. And so with that in mind, with knowing that information, he still took these three races.
Yeah. Well, then he's thinking he's going to get an audition to get on that bike. And
I think so, because I don't think you're going to shoot.
Maybe Cal stops.
I don't think Cal stops.
I don't think he will either, but I mean, that's a possibility.
The only thing I can logically think is that, let's say Zarco has a good weekend. Let's say he has a good three races, like a decent three races.
Okay. You know,
he finishes in the top 10. Maybe he has a great showing. He's in the top six. Okay. Let's say something crazy like that happens. Let's say he has a great showing. The only thing I think is that Honda go, yes, you on the Repsol bike, Jorge, get out of here. You don't want to be here. We don't want you here. And then Yamaha take Jorge back as a test rider. Why couldn't that happen? Far-fetched, but I think Zarco wouldn't have taken the opportunity if he didn't think it could lead to a full year of racing after this. So
yeah,
anyway,
I agree. All right.
We went down the rabbit hole on that one pretty far.
Yeah, that's enough.
With the facts being that Zarco will be on the bike in Phillip Island in a few days' time and for the rest of the season. So again, interesting thing to watch out for. Another huge rider announcement that dropped probably just an hour ago, as we record this around 7 o'clock on Wednesday the 23rd, is that Brad Binder has been moved up to the KTM factory team, and Iker Lekuona has been signed to go to the MotoGP Tech 3 KTM team. So there's a lot of gossip saying that Iker Lekuona was tagged to go to the factory KTM team, and while that seemed kind of fishy to me, there's never smoke without fire in the MotoGP journalism circles. So they weren't totally wrong, but this is going to be an interesting move. I'm excited to see Iker on the bike. I think Brad's going to do a great job in Moto 3. I think obviously Miguel is very comfortable with where he was in Tech 3 working with Guy Coulon, or else I'm sure KTM would have taken Miguel as he's doing outstanding this season. So interesting news. What's your take on it, Jim?
I really can't wait to see those guys ride the KTM next year. I really, really want to see Binder ride next to Paul. I just think that the two, you look at how Binder has raced this year, especially with the KTM Moto2 chassis, where he literally just grabs it by the scruff of the neck and just flings it around. And that is the kind of motorcycle he's going to inherit. He has no prior experience on a MotoGP bike. He doesn't know what a bike that does corner speed feels like versus a V4 that doesn't really carry corner speed. He doesn't have a difference. He's just going to go out there and go ride and do his thing. And I don't think it's going to be fire in a light catching lightning in a bottle. But I do think that Bender will put up some spectacular rides.
Yeah, I think KTM has seen that riders coming up without any notion of what a GP bike should be adapt maybe better than other riders who don't. And at the same time, I think they probably have the most talented young riders on their team between Miguel, Bender, and now Lecuona, who's only, I think he's 19, if just turned 20. So he's still a teenager.
Yeah, he's 19, right? He's 19. He won't turn 20 until shortly after Qatar, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, they have amazing talent. They've set themselves up in an internal structure very well, which is great, I guess, from a MotoGP side, because they don't have that perfect stepping stone ladder. Interesting that they didn't try to get Martin. You know, I don't know if they did and he didn't want to go, or if they just rate Lecuona even higher than that, or what's going on. I wonder how Martin feels about that. I just thought about that. You know, he's on the factory Moto2 bike, if you will.
Yep. So I think, Lecuona had...
It's interesting.
Okay, let me be sure I got this right. So correct me if I'm wrong here, but this is Lecuona's like second year on a Moto2 bike, right?
Second or third.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he's been in Moto2 longer than Martin has. I think Martin looked at the struggles that he had, and, you know, we'll get to it in the race, but he actually had a pretty good weekend in Japan. And I think it's better for Martin to get next year, get a Kalex or a speed up chassis, whatever it is that IO is going to use, and stay there, kind of be the number one guy in that team and see what he can do. I think that's a better position for him to be in than to kind of step off of something where you really don't know your setup yet. You don't know how to put it together because the frame wasn't working for anybody. So you learned a whole lot more about setup because that frame wasn't working. But I don't know if it's enough experience, enough of the right kind of experience to go right to Moto2. So I don't think Martin is by any means out of a running for getting a MotoGP ride at some, you know, maybe next year even. But I think he's better served to stay where he is.
Well, one, I don't even know if he had an offer. Two, I disagree with you to a degree. Like, my philosophy is, if you have the opportunity to go to MotoGP, go to MotoGP. Like, my whole thing is, like, we've seen Jack. You don't need Moto2. You have Alex Rins, you have Maverick Vinales. They did one season in Moto2. Not Rins did 2 years. Mir, right? So they had opportunities to go to MotoGP. They went to MotoGP. I think if you have the opportunity, you have to do it. Let's look at Danny Kent. Had an offer to go to Pramac Ducati directly from Moto3. He said, no, I'm going to go to Moto2. And let's look at where he is now. You know, like, things can change in motorcycle racing so quickly. So if you have the opportunity to go to GP, obviously there's a lot of circumstances that might not be right, and there's tons that go on behind the scenes. But I think at the end of the day, if you have the opportunity, you have to go, because you don't know what other opportunities you're going to get in these other classes. So, bit of a tangent on the KTM riders, but yeah.
It's what we do best.
As far as news goes,
we're done.
Lecuona to KTM MotoGP Tech 3, and Bender to the factory team. So that sums up our news. Jim, if you want to add anything, great. All right, so that's the news, folks. Now we get into our mini qualifying and race sessions. We're not going to do the full race reports that we generally do. These are going to kind of be slightly abbreviated just because we want to get through everything, and we want to get through everything in a timely fashion today. So we'll still talk about the qualifying sessions. We'll still talk about the races, but yeah, just kind of the highlights.
All right, so we'll go back. We'll get into the Motopod time machine and go back to the Thailand race. Now, full disclosure, I never saw the qualifying in any of these. I only saw the races. So if you want to just give us a quick rundown in the Moto3 deal, you can do that, Derek.
For Moto3 qualifying, let's see if I remember. This is pretty far back. I know I actually did watch these because I couldn't watch, you know, I did watch the Japan ones live, but the time zone difference is so weird for the Thailand. I wasn't able to watch anything.
All right. Well, we just get right to the race. That's
yeah. Let's go right to the race. Cause I don't think it was, again, you know, my feelings about Moto3 qualifying.
Yes, I know. Doesn't matter.
It's bullshit. Anyway.
So I think the scene is that we get the major players are out front, and you've got Canet and Delaporte are riding in the pack. They're in the 4, 5, 6 range, which is kind of where these guys usually are, and they're coming to the front. And we get to the first major talking point that exists in this race, and that's the fact that Darren Binder comes up the inside of Canet and causes a crash that takes Canet out of the race. Now, race direction saw fit to give Binder a ride-through penalty, which meant he was supposed to ride through the pit lane. However, he interpreted that as the long lap penalty, so he did that. Then he had to do the actual ride through the pit lane, and so he dropped all the way down. Now, I have been a staunch supporter of everything race direction has done so far this year. I have felt that their calls have been fair, they've been decent, and I think they've been appropriate for the most part for what was going on in the race. This one, I'm sorry, they blew this one in my opinion. This was purely a racing incident, and I say that based on this. Now, I only have the camera angles that I can see watching the race. I don't have extra access to other cameras, which supposedly people on Twitter said that that's what Race Direction had. They had multiple angles of this, and if you would see it from those angles, you'd realize that what Binder did was not professional, and he did cause the accident, and so he deserved the penalty. Well, I haven't, so I'm going to stay with what I saw, and it was a racing incident. You know, what happened was Binder made a move. He was completely alongside of Canet. It wasn't like he came from way back and dive-bombed in there. He was pretty much even with Canet into the braking zone. And what happened was Canet was unaware that Binder was there, which that's okay, but Canet basically got squeezed between the bike on the outside and Binder on the inside, and Canet had to basically grab a whole lot more front brake than what he wanted. He tucked the front, and everybody kind of went down. And that's what happened. And that's a racing incident in my mind. To me, Binder wound up getting hosed with a call for the ride-through penalty only because he has a reputation of being this guy who dive bombs in and causes trouble. And if he had done this to anybody else that wasn't in the championship fight, I believe that he would not have received a penalty at all for it. It would have been just a racing incident. That's how I see it.
Yeah, Jim, I totally feel the same way about the Binder incident. I think from a perspective of it was a racing incident, but I think it's Race Direction's message to Binder as well, saying you're in these incidents too many, like this, you need to calm down. You know, I while I don't think it was as blatant of a Binderism as we've seen from him, I don't think it was the wrong decision. I think a long lap penalty would have been much more appropriate But I think they were also trying to make a statement with him being like, you can't ride like this regardless of who was in it. And I think the cherry on top and maybe the reason why he got a full ride through as opposed to a long lap is that it was a title contender. But I do agree with you. I do think it was a racing incident, but I think they're trying to send a message to Binder at this point because they obviously see him as some sort of risk, which unfortunately this year he kind of has been. At the end of last year, he was showing flashes of his brother. That's unfair to make him live up to that standard, I guess, just to compare him to his brother. That must suck. But at the same time, like, he was doing so good. And now he's definitely struggling. So just to keep it upright, and having the nickname Dive Bomb Darren from the commentators certainly doesn't help either. And can influence race direction's decision and opinion on what they do.
Yeah, I see. That's a good way to look at it. I see your side of it. But you know, it's race direction. They've got to make their thing. And if they wanted to make a statement with him, okay, I'll go with that. But I think if you were going to do it, you should have set him down before a race and said, look, you can't do this crap anymore. And if you do this again, you are going to get this ride through. Now, maybe that happened. I don't know. But I would prefer that they had gone about it that way. And then if he did this, then the punishment fits the crime because there's a backstory to it. Like, look, we told you if you did this, this is what's going to happen kind of a thing, as opposed to like, hey, he's in the middle of what I consider to be a racing incident. And oh, by the way, we're going to throw the book at you for it. So yeah, it's either way, I think no matter how you look at it, I think that race direction kind of botched this one. But hey, they've been good all year. Everybody gets a mulligan.
Anyway, yeah, so the crash was definitely a big turning point in the championship and the race overall. But really, I'd say, again, as Moto 3 does, the last five laps were, again, really, really, really good. You know, yeah. You had De La Porta, you had Alonso Lopez, who came to the forefront, who was staying in track limits this time, which was great to see. You had Arenas. You also had Minho, who was up there and has really kind of shown a lot more form at the back half of this season than I normally feel like he does. I feel like he normally starts the championship great, and then the last couple of years has just not done very well. That's actually another news topic, is that Minho signed for Moto 3 VR46. So we will be seeing him back in those colors with the team he was already on. So that's just a little tidbit. But yeah, those last five laps, unfortunately, Minho ended up doing what he did in Misano. He took out Ayagura on the last lap and broke the pack up. So it really was just a race for to the line, I guess, throughout the whole lap between Arenas, De La Porta, and Lopez. And it was a great last lap.
It was. It really was. I mean, I thought, you know, we kind of saw what we usually see. De La Porta kind of doing the donkey work, leading out front, and then gets taken at the very end and misses out on 25 points, because that would have been, you know, that'd been five more points than what he would have gotten for second place at 20 points. And, you know, again, here's another opportunity for De La Porta when his closest championship rival has had an issue and is not going to score points, and yet you can't capitalize and take maximum advantage of that. The other thing, too, in the race that helps De La Porta's championship is the Arbolino incident, where he had the glove and he, you know, tried to loosen it up, and he had that numbness or the arm pump or however you want to look at it on his right hand, which was a bad news deal for him. So that really pretty much crushed any chance of the championship that Arbolino had. De La Porta capitalized as best he could. He did finish second. And then we found out that his grandmother had died, and he was racing with a very heavy heart. And I get the impression that he was very close to his grandma. And, you know, to try to set that aside and race your heart out knowing that this might be, you know, you're not going to get another chance at a Moto 3 world title, and you could conceivably maybe not get another chance at a world title again, and you know you've got to capitalize on it, was a pretty good, strong mental ride by Della Porta to get there. So I was impressed by that too. But Arenas did it all right. I mean, he snookered everybody and took it on the last lap, which was a great finish.
Yeah, solid race. Probably, unsurprisingly, probably the best race of that weekend, in my opinion, just from an overall perspective. Yeah, that sums up Moto 3 in Thailand. We're going to stay in Thailand and go over the Moto 2 race.
Okay, so the Moto 2 race, it was an interesting race from the take of that Alex Marquez really couldn't get anything going in this race. He had issues. He was there or thereabouts, but that isn't exactly what he really wanted. But the surprise of it all, I think, was Luca Marini, who really hadn't been anywhere throughout the season, yet he shows up and bangs in a win. And he did it by beating Binder. And Binder, you know, did a classic Brad Binder, got a great start, got out front, kind of was holding on to it. And at the end, Binder was right there. He, you know, was really, you know, was beaten by, not that, you know, beaten by about 3 seconds, because he basically had ran out of tire on the back. Lekuona was third in the race, which meant two KTMs on the podium. And I think that might be the first time that's happened so far this year. But if you look, Jorge Martin was sixth. So he was right there with Binder and not too far off the pace. So that was, you know, a good ride for Martin, in which he kind of carries on that momentum as he goes to Japan. But Fernandez wound up finishing just ahead of Marquez. And I think Marquez maybe was thinking that he needed to just sort of kind of put the marker on Fernandez. You know, he needed to basically just keep him in sight because he is the closest championship rival that he has. But I think by doing that, Marquez kind of lost sight of where Binder is, because now Binder had moved into to second in the championship and with this race. So Binder, who was nowhere to be found in the early part of the championship, is now suddenly right there, and he's kind of the hottest rider since Silverstone. So it was a pretty interesting race in that respect from those 3 points. What do you think, Derek?
I think it was Binder's looked on form. He's looked great. Marini, it's nice to see him back to the form he was in last year. He obviously found something at Aragon, so again, it's great to have someone else fighting up front, and that can really mix it up between Fernandez and Marquez, and can kind of, Marini can almost be actually a very large catalyst to see if Binder can kind of get in this. If Marquez makes any mistake, you know, Binder's back in. It was a bit of a quiet race, but overall, not the most enthralling Moto 2 encounter. No. Nice to see Iker Lekuona on the podium.
I thought that was great.
He's been so close, especially in was it in Sachsenring this year? It was the last corner, and then he just crashed out on that uphill left hander there. So yeah, I don't have too much to add on this race.
It wasn't the most spectacular race. It was one of those you're just kind of watching the laps go by, and that's okay. You know, there was a good race to come, so maybe we should just move forward and talk about the MotoGP race.
Let's.
Okay. Well, I don't know. You may have heard about this. There's this guy named Marquez, and like, he had a chance to win the championship this race. I hear he's pretty good, but there's also this kid named Fabio Quartararo, who's also very good, and you knew the race was going to be between those two guys, and you thought maybe Vinales would have a little bit of a chance starting where he was on the front row with the guys, but Marquez took off, and Quartararo promptly got by, and Vinales was right there with him, but then Vinales sort of had his same problem where we get past like lap 4 to 6, he suddenly starts to drop off times for 4 or 5 laps while both Marquez and Quartararo just keep the hammer down and keep pounding in the laps. And for whatever reason, Vinales can't do those lap times. I don't know if it's a fuel load thing, a feel thing, a tire thing. I'm not too sure what it is, but it's something that he really needs to work on and try to find it, because he would probably be in the mix and we'd have a great three-way battle as opposed to having a great two-way battle. But Quartararo basically wound up leading the entire race. And basically, you knew Marquez was going to come after him at the end somewhere. You just didn't know where he was going to do it. But you kind of got a feel for what was going on. Like, Marquez had a lot more top-end speed and better braking going into turn 3. So you thought Marquez would maybe do that. Because Marquez's best sector is the middle sector of the track, where it's the tightest, sort of the twistiest part of it. But then once you get to the back straight, that's Quartararo territory. That was where the Yamahas were really fast. They got a couple fast sweeps there, which is, I think, what, turns 10 and 11 there by that grandstand. And then you had the corner that is another one of the, I think, great corners of racetracks. I mean, if you could put this corner in like to some other tracks, you'd have a great racetrack, because this track and this corner, everybody wants to dive bomb in there, go lit on the brakes, and box people out, because the start finish line is not that far up the end. So at that last lap, Marquez got by, but he didn't do it at turn 3. He did it with a bold move through 5 and 6, which is where he had flung himself to the moon in FP1 on Friday, who necessitated a trip to the hospital because he'd bruised himself up so bad and was having a little trouble breathing. Yet the kid comes back and was right there, makes another bold move in the place where he fell off, which shows he has no fear whatsoever. Quartararo then realizes that he only has one chance now to get back past Marquez, and that's at the final turn on the circuit. He goes for it, tries it, he's all out of shape. Marquez sees it coming, knows it's coming, cuts back underneath, and nips him at the line to win the race and the world championship, because Dovizioso finished 4th. So that's the race. Great race by Marquez. Great race by Fabio Quartararo. If this is how the championship next year is going to be between Quartararo and Marquez, give me one of these races every weekend, I am all for it, because that was a fabulous race that these two guys put on.
Yeah, and hopefully it's closer next year, because I think Yamaha is doing all the right things, so hopefully it's a bit closer. But yeah, it was a good race. I just felt like it was one of those things that I was watching, and it's like I knew exactly what was coming. You know, it was like inevitable. While yeah. It was close and exciting at the end, it was just like it was inevitable. You know, I think that's one thing Quartararo needs to learn and kind of go through, are these you know, Marquez attacks, and he's gonna learn. Oh, Mark's gonna you know, do the cutback. Mark's going to go around the outside. He's going to do this. He's going to do that.
You know the real irony of that? The real irony is that Marquez learned that from Dovizioso.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's what's happened. But that's...
So it's just a matter of learning who you're racing and knowing the strengths or weaknesses of their bike. And I think Quartararo has proven himself that he can adapt and he can learn. So it's only a matter of time until he gets through that. So... yeah, great race overall, especially from a very neutral perspective. But yeah, it was watching it, I was like, there's no way Mark's not going to win, right? Especially after
he wanted it.
You could tell, especially after that crash. I think that's a huge talking point of the weekend.
Right,
that crash, you know, made him almost seem vulnerable, and that's not Mark Marquez. You know,
yep.
He has to outdo everyone always, and that's really one of his, besides Austin, which kind of wasn't even his problem, it was a mechanical issue, that's really been like the one major blip of his season. And it was in a practice session, and he still topped the session, he still topped the weekend, and he won the championship. So, you know, I'm sure people quickly forget about that, but I think that's a huge talking point of the weekend.
Oh yeah, I think it is too. I mean, he The mind games between Quartararo and Marquez are on. That game is on and it's full tilt. And Marquez was not going to let Quartararo win at all, because it would have showed that there is a weakness. And Marquez does not want to show Quartararo that he has any weakness.
Yeah. So I think once Quartararo cracks it, it's going to be floodgates, you know?
Yes.
So
it's going to be a mind game. But yeah, but I'll ask quickly, what'd you think of the championship celebration by Marquez?
They're awful.
Okay.
They're terrible. I wasn't into it.
And what didn't work for you?
Maybe I'm just, it's just because I'm not a Marquez fan. That I just like couldn't do it.
I thought it was kind of cool with the pool table and he sinks the eight ball for eight championships. I thought it was cool, but I like Marquez. I'm not so sure that they have the flair that the Rossi championships have had, but
no, yeah. Because I feel like because Rossi pioneered that whole celebration, or maybe because it feels almost not as genuine.
Yeah.
At this point.
Well, it was so predictable. Like, he was going to win. You just knew it, right?
Yeah. Because I obviously like the, like right, so BSB, as Dave and Andy will get to, was this past weekend. And as, spoiler alert, if you will, hit pause, fast forward if you don't want to know, but I'm sure y'all know, that Scott Redding won the BSB title. His celebration was fantastic, but it was filled with just pure raw emotion. But they put him on a red chair. He had a bunch of friends in the Beefeater costumes, and they like carried him. They rolled out the red carpet. It was so over the top, but at the same time, it was like pure emotion from him. You know, especially seeing him on the Aprilia last year to winning a championship. So obviously, like, I like the weird gaudy celebrations, but I feel like the Marquez ones are just like kind of just because, like, he wasn't fighting with anyone for the championship. It was just kind of a foregone thing. I don't know. I explained that way too much, but not huge on the celebrations.
All right, well, let's move to Japan then. So let's get on the plane and fly from Thailand to Japan, and we'll talk about the race this past weekend. So we had the that super typhoon that kind of went through Japan just prior to the MotoGP guys getting there, which left us with some kind of little odd weather that was going on. It was a dry practice on Friday. Saturday was wet. It had rained overnight, and when Moto3 qualifying started, it was a wet session with rain. The guys that were in the first session, Arbolino, Masia, Foggia, Fanati, Antonelli, they're all in the Q1 session, and everybody goes out, and it's interesting because it's wet. Masia was in a position to advance, but he crashed, so the marshals grabbed his bike, and they're like literally walking off with it. And he's like, no, bring it back. I want to go back. I want it back. And so it was kind of 5-1, and he wasn't able to get his bike back, which I thought was just kind of funny. You had he was waiting to see if he could advance, but he wasn't able to because it's a wet session. And what do we know about wet sessions? The longer you run, the faster you get. And so the very last bit of it was always people were changing around. So Lopez, Antonella, Garcia, and Yurchenko all advanced into the second session. When we got into the second session, we had a Agüero with a high side, which was off throttle and lost the rear end at turn four. So it was definitely tricky still conditions. But there was a great little battle there between Yurchenko and Lopez. Yurchenko was basically running in front. Lopez was behind him. And they kept going faster, lap after lap after lap. But every time Yurchenko would go to the pole, Lopez would go with him, and he would be just that little bit faster. But at the end, Suzuki was looking very good, but it became Antonelli was the one who wound up really pushing very hard at the end with Suzuki. So Antonelli was on the pole, then Lopez, Suzuki, Yurchenko, Garcia, Della Porta, Kornfeld, and Kinnett in eighth, and Vietti in ninth. So there's your front three rows. So you got your championship contenders, Della Porta starting from the sixth position, and Canet coming from eighth. So it was going to be an interesting race, to say the least, on that one. Now, in the race, at the beginning, Kornfeld falls at turn four, and then he takes out Rodrigo, and then he was doing an interview with Simon Crafar and says, "It's not my fault." Well, as the announcer said, I think Rodrigo would disagree with that, and he had every right to, because really, in all honesty, Kornfeld kind of just dive-bombed up the inside and put his bike in a place where there was no place for Lopez to go, because if you're on the outside, you can't move away as fast as someone who's on the inside can turn away from you. And pretty much, Kornfeld just clawed it, just absolutely clawed it, Rodrigo. And so both of those guys go down. Did you see it differently, Derek, or did you think it was definitely a Kornfeld thing?
100% is Kornfeld on that one. And, and like I've been saying, Rodrigo, luck is just terrible this year.
It's brutal. You know? It's brutal. His luck has been brutal. We had that little kind of squabble, if you will, as things went on there. But Canet and Della Porta are kind of working their way up from their starting positions. They're moving to the front as things are going. Oh, I guess I should say, out of that hurdle, the whole first lap kind of crazy that was going on, Tom Booth Amos kind of ran up the backside of somebody's tire and wound up like sliding on his back all the way down the straightaway from four to five, which was rather interesting. So you sort of had a lot of chaos there at the beginning. As I said, Canet and Della Porta kind of are racing their way to the front, and we get to where Canet runs wide, and he loses a couple of places. He falls back to fifth, and then Della Porta kind of uses that as a springboard to go to the front. So Della Porta's got out front. He kind of is holding on to the lead out front. Again, he's doing the donkey work that he's been so famous for this year. And then we wound up with a huge championship event, and that is the fact that Canet wound up crashing at turn nine. He lost the front, and he was not going to score any more points. Granted, he was up quickly. He was back on the bike, but the whole pack had pretty much come by him, and there's no way Canet was going to go any farther. He actually wound up stopping and pulling into the pits, and you could tell by his body language how he was talking, how he was pushing the front so hard, trying to keep up with the Hondas. And I think we've kind of seen it this year that the Honda seems to be definitely a little bit better on acceleration than the KTMs. And it goes to show just how hard Canet was having to ride to keep up with Della Porta. But as soon as Canet had fallen, the boys at the Leopard team put out the board showing Della Porta that Canet had crashed and was out and would not score any points. And to Della Porta's credit, he just basically rode a smart race out front from there on, and he just drove away and won the race in pretty good fashion. Our good friend Arenas was right there again from Thailand, looking good as well on the KTM. But Vietti came in at the very end and just nipped Suzuki, Suzuki was actually second, I think, going into the final corner. And he got burned both by Arenas and Vietti. So Suzuki winds up in fourth. And Garcia, who had a really good ride, was fifth. McPhee was right there in sixth. And then Masia, seventh. Ramirez, eighth. Lopez was ninth. And Mignot, tenth. And that's kind of left us with a championship where Della Porta now sits on 229 points to Canet's 182 points. So he's got a 47-point lead going into Phillip Island. If Della Porta leaves Phillip Island with a lead of 50 points, he'll win the title in Australia. So it's conceivable the Moto 3 championship can be clinched then. Got anything else you want to add to that pretty decent Moto 3 race in Japan, Derek?
No, Jim, I think that was a fantastic summary. If I will say, I do hope Della Porta wraps it up in Phillip Island. I think it's it's like such an iconic track. It's like such a track. And I don't know when the last title was that was wrapped up there. The last thing I think of is Stoner in 2011, but
that's what I was thinking too. Yeah. I'm not sure.
I don't think, I'm trying to think if any other ones have been.
No, because Marquez has never wrapped one up there.
Yeah, it's a lot of them have been done in Japan and Sepang. Sepang's a big one.
Yes.
Especially for the Moto 2 and Moto 3 titles. So.
Yes.
Anyway, I mean, for no apparent reason other than it's a glorious track and it's probably going to be cold and wet this weekend. So.
Oh, yeah. We'll see, though. This could be gnarly. We weekend it down on the island. So yeah. I'm looking forward to watching.
We're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yes,
we're getting ahead of ourselves.
You know, I'll give you a fun fact from Moto3 Race. I have been pulling for Della Porta all year long, simply because he's got a 48 on the bike, and that's the number that were on my that was on my bikes. So I really have been pulling for Della Porta to win just because there for that. But he's also been riding really well, so I can't take anything away from him. I feel gutted for Kinnett. He kind of has been on the backside of all the luck, so. Yeah, it's a bit rough for him, but, you know, that's he's got a Moto2 ride, so he's moving up. So, really, you know, we'll just have to see what plays out at the island. I mean, anything's possible. You know, it's pack racing in Moto3 at a very fast track, so we just have to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, look at Scott Redding in, what was it, 2012, where he was leading the championship by, like, 40 points, and then he broke his hand in Phillip Island, and that was that.
How's that? Yeah, anything can happen. It's racing. That's why we race. So let's look at Moto 2 qualifying quickly. So again, it was Saturday. We had the rain. The rain had stopped, and we were starting to kind of see a little bit of a dry line that was working in there. We had Bezzecchi, who had a bike problem, and we had Binder was sitting around in the pits. He only had like three laps in, and he was just sitting in the pits, and he had his helmet on. I couldn't really figure out, like, what in the world was going on? Like, what's the IO team doing? Why is Binder not out there? And then it kind of got to where, hey, Gardner's going out, and he's going to be on slicks. I'm like, ooh, that's like a serious gamble, because it was still pretty wet, and it was going to take a little bit of time for those slicks to get heat in them, if you could get the heat in it, because the track was pretty cold. But it was a bold move. And then you saw Binder go down the pit lane after Gardner. I'm like, oh, that's why Binder's sitting in the pits. He's waiting to put slicks on the bike too. So these guys go, Binder and Gardner go to slicks. It was a bit early. They really couldn't get enough heat in the tires to get it to work. But our good friend, yes, go ahead.
Did they even get a flying lap in on the slicks, though?
Gardner
did. I don't think they did, because Gardner, his tire warmer was stuck on the tire. They couldn't get it off. So he got out of the pit, like, maybe 30 seconds later than he meant to. So I don't know.
I don't think either of them did. I don't think either of them did. I think Gardner maybe might have made it by a second. I know Binder didn't get a flying lap, because he was way too late to get to it there. But it was brave, and I give him credit for trying it, that's for sure. The interesting thing was that the guy who winds up on pole is our good friend Luca Marini. So Marini now suddenly, like, the light switch is clicked on, right? And he's just going fast. But he kind of forgot something before he left the pits, and that was a set of knee sliders. And Maverick Vinales comes running off of the pit box and runs across pit lane and says, hey, you don't have knee sliders on. So that sent the crew rushing in to go get his knee sliders. I thought that was pretty great. I mean, I can't say that I've ever done that myself when I was racing, but I think it just shows that Marini was just in the zone, and he was thinking about racing a bike, and he just wasn't thinking about what else he needed to actually race a motorcycle. Like, maybe some knee sliders would be good. So
yeah, for sure.
But Marini, all credit to Marini, he went out, and he just kept going faster and faster and faster and faster, and as a track driver, he just kept going faster, and so that put him on pole. Another guy looking good was Augusto Fernandez, who was second. Baldassare finally looking to show some pace. He was there in third. And then we get to Alex Marquez, who actually makes it in fourth. And, you know, we talked about his brother last weekend having an amazing crash in FP1. Well, here in Japan, his, you know, the younger Marquez, Alex, winds up with an incredible save in free practice in the wet on Saturday. Even Randy Mamola chimed in on it and thought it was a pretty brilliant save, because he pretty much was straight out horizontal, planked on the motorcycle with two hands on the handlebars, and both tires of the bike are actually off the ground in the photo that I saw of it, the still shot of it. But he put it together to get a fourth in the rain. Navarro was there in fifth. the surprise, I guess, was Chantra, some cat Chantra. The tie rider was looking good. He was there in sixth. Luthi was then seventh. Vizeki was eighth without throwing up in his helmet yet. He will later. And then Schroeder in ninth. And you had Gardner then in 10th for the qualifying. So I think we were looking forward to a really pretty decent Moto2 race. Again, it's now sunshine and it's all dry. It's Sunday. Things are looking good. But Nakashima had a crash on the siding lap. I don't know what happened there. And then it was a bit of confusion because they had done a siding lap, but it got himself to the end of the pit lane and was waiting, and he was there before they had taken off to do the warm-up lap. Now, there was some confusion. I thought he was going to have to start from pit lane, although Simon Crafar told us that no, he was going to be able to start from the back of the grid, essentially take up the last position on the grid and start from there, which is what he actually did. Yet, at the beginning of the race, at the start, he got to turn one and he crashed. So, that one took him out of the race, but that was a bad weekend for Nakashima. No question about it. I don't know what was there, but all the big crashing really hadn't stopped. It was just getting started because Brad Binder, basically he started well back because he, again, tried the slicks. So he was 18th off the grid. He was coming around. He actually got off the track and he got into the wet grass with the back tire. So a slick on wet grass doesn't work. We know that. He came back on with a wicked tank slapper that he did his best to actually control and get straight, only to be clipped by Alex Lowes, who was going 100 miles an hour probably, if not a little bit more. And the impact was so great on Bender's bike that it ripped the clip on, or broke the clip on the left clip on of Lowe's machine completely off. It was actually just hanging down beside the bike, and that forced Lowe's to actually retire. Binder was a very, very lucky boy in that instance, wasn't he, Derek?
Yes. Sorry, I zoned out for a second, Joe.
No, that's fine. I was on a roll there. I just, I needed a break. I had to catch some air. So no worries, man. But yeah, I think Binder was very lucky with that one. I mean, I think Lowe's was lucky too, because that could have been, that crash could have been a whole lot worse than it was.
Yeah. The get together was not a good one. But besides that, I think the race overall is just, again, a solid one. Like, this was right. So much better than
Thailand,
mm-hmm. Between Luthi and Marini. And then I think
the interesting thing was Alex Marquez, because Alex was actually had like no grip on the rear. He missed the setup, didn't get it right, whatever, right? But he was fighting tooth and nail for everything. I mean, he had elbows out. He would take turn 11 and just pretty much dive it up the inside and, push people out of the way. But Marini, you're right, Marini was out front. And Marini was riding a good race, and you thought, well, Marini's going to wind up with like two on the trot here because, he got Thailand. Something got the light switch flipped on in Aragon, right? Next thing you know, he's got a win. He's got a pole. Well, shoot, he's going to wind up doing a double here. But there's a guy named Thomas Luthi who really hasn't done anything since the first three races of the year, the first flyaways. And then, now here we are at the back end with the flyaways, and Luthi's like got pace. And Luthi was just cruising on through the pack. And him and Marini kind of had like a real ding-dong back and forth, which was great to watch.
It was. That was probably the highlight of the flyaways so far, just in terms of battles.
Agreed.
Because even the... again, like, I don't... The Thailand MotoGP race was great, but it wasn't a battle. There were like two main passes in that whole race. But this was like that was a good scrap for a while. At the end, Marini kind of stretched it out a bit. The last couple of laps, it wasn't a last lap battle, but I think the two biggest surprises were Jorge Martin was able to get up there and eventually finish on the podium in third, which is his first podium of his Moto2 career.
Mm-hmm. Well earned.
Yeah, which I think, again, Binder and Martin on that bike to be able to get on podiums is amazing, and it tells you a lot about the rider and obviously about the team too. So that was a big thing. But then to see Baldessari back up there and not too far off the winner was incredibly important just for his self-confidence going into next year. He's on the same team. He's going to have the same teammate. And he's going to need to compete. So obviously this year wasn't his year, even though it seemed like it was shaping up to be that way. But he needs to get back on track so that once the beginning of next year comes around, he can start off as strong as he did this year and hopefully carry it. Hopefully there's not, again, tire changes and whatnot that screw with riders during the season. So, I think Martin and Baldessari are my biggest takeaways of that race, just from a confidence perspective.
Sure. So the race finished off, as you said, Marini got back by Luthi, and he won the race. Luthi finished second. And by finishing second, Luthi's now second in the championship, and he's only 36 points behind Alex Marquez. My question to you, Derek, has Alex Marquez lost his mojo?
I don't think he's lost his mojo. I think it's Moto 2, and if we look at the difference in finishing order and gaps, everything's so close together. Checking out this race. The results here. Yeah, Marquez, or I guess he finished 7 seconds behind. But even still, like, he's in the top six, and in Moto 2, that's a close finish still. Yeah. I don't think he's lost his mojo. I think he's still on course to take this championship. I think if he makes an Alex Marquez of old mistake in the next couple rounds, which we can't put by him, though this season he's really made limited number of the mistakes that he was so well known for.
Yeah. Really, the that's going to determine was, if... I was going to say, really, the only one of those usual Alex Marquez-type errors was Silverstone, and he hasn't done it. That was really the only error he's really made this year. Otherwise, he's pretty much rode a really great season.
Exactly. So, like you said, it's racing and anything can happen, but I think as long as he keeps steady, and again, championships are about consistency as well, and a top six in Moto 2 where the leader and the names above you aren't the same every week. This would be like, this is like an ideal Dovizioso championship, you know, where the winner changes every weekend, and as long as you're consistent, you're good. Yeah. But that's not the way MotoGP works. Alex Marquez is doing a Dovi. He's just being consistent. He's getting the wins when he can. When he can't, he's finishing sixth, and he's not finishing on the floor.
He tried. So I think he tried this race to be on the floor, but he definitely rode well. I agree.
Yeah. So, I don't think he's lost his mojo. I think the next couple of races will be good, and he'll win one of the three.
Okay.
Don't know which one.
Fair enough.
He's gonna win one of the three. That's my prediction.
Cool. I like it. One of the next three. Nice. So basically, Brad Binder's championship is now over, given his finish of where was Binder was in 12th. After that incident. So Binder's challenge is pretty much over because he's only on 184 points. Navarro, and that puts him fifth in the championship. Navarro is fourth at 186. His championship is pretty much done. So the battle is between Marquez, who is in first on 234, Luthi second on 198, which is a 36-point deficit, and then Augusto Fernandez, who's on 192. So these three guys are going to decide this championship, and quite honestly, if you look at it, you got to believe that it's still Marquez's title, only because Marquez has been the most consistent of those three guys. That is for sure. I would not put it past Luthi to win at Phillip Island. I would not put it past Marquez to actually win at Malaysia. And then Valencia is a toss-up as to who is going to win there. Although the high-speed track, Binder may throw one in there on the KTM. So going to be interesting to see how that all shakes out. So that's Moto 2. Anything else, Derek, for Moto 2 before we go to MotoGP?
I'll just say a little bit of a prediction for Phillip Island this weekend.
Okay, I'm good.
With Remy being Remy.
Okay.
And with Phillip Island being not the greatest forecast for the weekend, I think we are in prime opportunity to see Remy Gardner take a win at Phillip Island if it's wet. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm going with.
God, I think
there's a lot of big ifs there.
There are.
But if it's wet, I think we could see him on the top step.
Nice.
Just throwing that out there.
I like that.
Something to think about for the weekend.
All right. All right. There you heard it, guys. You heard it here first. Remy Gardner winning Phillip Island. If it rains, Derek said so. I like it. I like it, Derek. I do. Let's go to MotoGP in Japan. So in the first qualifying session, Rins and Cowell are in Q1. We are definitely on to slicks now. We've definitely got a dry line because FP, after the qualifying, was Moto3, Moto2, a FP4 session for MotoGP, and then the qualifying session at the end of the day. So the track had dried out. There was a dry line. But we now know the Suzuki cannot get the best out of those tires, the soft Michelins. For whatever reason, Rins can't make it happen. There was a pretty good battle for the top two spots between Crutchlow, Paul Espargaró, Rins, and Nakano. But in the end, Crutchlow and Rins do advance into this all-important second qualifying session. In the second qualifying session, well, Marquez just goes out and sets the pace with an incredibly strong first run. Him and Vinales are technically sort of battling it out. They're trying to figure out who's going to be first and second, but well, there's a guy named Morbidelli and Quartararo who then threw down laps at the very end of it to beat Vinales, but they couldn't really touch Marquez. So Marquez earns yet one more pole position, Morbidelli with a second position, and then Quartararo followed by Vinales. So it's a Honda then all the Yamahas on a track that in the last few years Yamaha has not really done very well at qualifying.
They haven't, and I think that's a big thing for Yamaha to be so competitive here. And I think that's why we're seeing them go in the right direction, and between hopefully them getting a better engine and some electronics engineers moving seats from other teams to go to Yamaha, I think they have a real shot at really having a very competitive package next year.
Oh, yeah.
So right. It's good to see, especially at Motegi, where the two huge straights, stop starts, and they haven't been going well here the last couple of years. So I think it's going to be really good.
I think it bodes well for Yamaha. They've definitely looks like they maybe got it going in the right direction, and you can see why. And then Jarvis wants Fabio Quartararo's name on a contract for 2021, but Quartararo and his manager are being very coy about that, and they realize that every race that he runs on that bike makes his value that much more. And here's the question. Rossi has a contract until his contract runs through next year, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So at the end of 2020, Rossi's either got to renew and stay with Yamaha, or Rossi retires, or whatever Rossi's going to do, right? So let's assume Rossi says, "Oh, I'm going to keep riding." And you've got Vinales. What are you gonna do? You've already given, Quartararo a full-on factory spec bike for next year. That's been agreed to. Petronas will have a factory spec that's equivalent to what the Monster Energy Yamahas have. So, if you've got Quartararo's name on a contract, it really isn't any different, because you're gonna have to leave him in the Petronas team, right? If Rossi says he's gonna keep riding, are you gonna be Lynn Jarvis and tell Rossi no?
Yeah, I think it's going to work out nicely, because Rossi said he's not going to decide until around the first six races. He's going to do the first six races and decide if he wants to continue.
Mm-hmm.
And on the flip side of it, Quartararo doesn't want to sign a contract yet, because as he gets better and as things are keep getting better, he's just building up more value.
Sure.
And perceived value. So it's possible that the rider market is going to be a little bit backed up. It's not going to be signing contracts before the first night in Qatar.
Marquez might.
Marquez might. But I think for the majority of the grid, it may be a little halted just because Rossi.
Yes.
He can hold things up. So I personally don't think he'll go another year. I think that qualifying session and as we'll get to the race is a great show of it, Morbidelli, Quartararo, Vinales, all within 3/10 of pole position, and then Rossi's down in 10th. Yep. So yeah, he's like a second behind, basically. Eight tenths behind.
I will throw this little tidbit at you. I noticed, and I just, when they showed Rossi and all of his championships that he had in the MotoGP class, I realized Rossi's last title was 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That I just didn't realize it had been that long. And yeah. Heck, what I just saw on Twitter today, it's literally 8 years since we lost Marco Simicelli. I was like, oh my gosh, it's been 8 years, but
yeah,
it's sad. But anyway, let's talk about the fun and the positives.
Yeah, no, but yeah, I think just to button that up from a contract perspective, I think he's gonna have a hard time. Lynn Jarvis is gonna have a hard time if Rossi decides to continue.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the only person who knows right now if he's thinking about it is Rossi himself. So.
Sure.
Yeah. So we'll see. Anyway, we can go to the race.
Yeah, I want to go to the siding lap first.
All right, let's go to the siding lap. Okay.
So in the siding lap, Marquez comes around on reins, and that threw everybody for a loop. I mean, the look of the Ducati mechanics when they pushed his bike up pit lane was a look of absolute gobsmack. Now, everybody was speculating in the commentary booth that Marquez had done it to scrub in a set of reins because it was cloudy, and if it was going to be flag to flag, Marquez would have had a set of tires scrubbed in. After the race, Marquez is asked that question, and he says, oh yeah, it was cloudy, it was maybe going to rain, and our bike is better when we have a scrub set of wets. Okay? That's all a bunch of BS. I'll tell you exactly what I think Marquez was doing. When we first saw on camera Marquez coming to the line, to the grid, on the siding lap, he was completely tucked in and down under the bubble as tight as he could get to the tank on that motorcycle. And then we could see that he had wets. Now, any wet tire that I had on my bike would increase the diameter or the circumference of the tire, which meant that if you had a set of reins on with the same gearing, you would have a taller gearing, which means you'd save more fuel going to the grid. And Motegi is a thirsty track on bikes. I think it was a smart move for Marquez to go with a taller geared motorcycle, tuck in behind the windscreen, and save fuel so he'd have enough fuel to get to the end of the race. I think that's what he did, and I think it was a strategy move that he did, and I think it caught everybody off guard, but I thought it was brilliant. That's what I'm going with. Even though Mark denies it, I still think that's what they did. Anyway.
Yeah, I think that's excellent observation and rational piecing together of the situation. I fast forwarded the whole pregame, if you will, and went right to the lights drop, so I didn't see that happen. So
yeah. It was definitely interesting.
Yeah, it makes sense though. Yeah, because as we'll fast forward to the end of the race, Marquez runs out of fuel
right
at the cool down lap.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not uncommon for Motegi at all. So
no, not
at but all. Yeah, very smart. Did you see that tweet? I think it was from Matt Oxley who was like, there's a section in the rule book that says you can't switch gas tanks on the grid,
right?
Because Kenny Roberts did that and to save fuel.
Yep.
And there wasn't a rule about it then, so he was able to do it, but pretty funny. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, Motegi, lots of gasoline.
Lots of gas. It's start stop, lots of acceleration, so it's going to burn up the fuel. So Oh, go ahead, Derek.
No, I was just going to get to the race. Leica was out. It was a great first lap, and then it just kind of was a light snoozer, I'd call it.
Yeah, I agree. Marquez got the hole shot. Strategy plan number one, get hole shot, get out front, get away from everybody, control race from the front. Marquez did all four of those. That was for sure. The real race was basically watching, let's put it this way. Miller had a great start to be second, but Miller lost all of his pace. He had a grip issue. He went from being as high as second all the way back to where he wound up finishing way, way down the order in 10th. He, you know, like I said, there was no grip at all for the boy there. But the really good ride was Dovizioso. Dovizioso came from his lowly 7th position on the grid, slowly worked his way up. He kept picking people off. He used the acceleration of the Ducati and the great braking stability of the Ducati to get past everybody and work his way up the pack, eventually finishing 3rd and even on the podium, which was fantastic to see. Now, at the beginning of the race, everybody was trying to figure out what tire they were going to use. Marquez had gone out in that morning warm-up session on a medium-medium combination. He set some times that were just fantastic. So he put the medium tire on, even though at the time that they were starting an hour later in Japan than normal. So the track temperature was going to cool off as the sun tends to set there relatively early. Knowing that, and with a little bit of cloud cover that had rolled in, both Morbidelli, Quartararo, Vinales, and Dovi all switched from mediums to softs on the grid. Now, that hurt Miller because he was going nowhere with it. Quartararo, who ran around basically in second place for the entire race, had some grip issues, but he did save enough tire at the end because he knew he couldn't go with Marquez, so he saved enough tire to fend off Dovizioso. Although, if it had been one lap longer, I gotta think that Dovizioso probably would have gotten Quartararo, and you would have seen him second, but that's not the case. Vinales was sort of in the same boat. He did not have the proper tire on the bike, and he had a grip issue as well. Crutchlow was your 5th place man. He had a great ride, having come from that from his starting position. Cal did about as best as he could. The Suzukis were in touch, relatively. I would have thought the Suzukis would have done a little bit better here than they did, but they weren't getting it working. I think they'll do better in at the island. I mean, everybody goes better at the island because it's just a track where the rider makes up all the difference, but this wasn't exactly the greatest of MotoGP races, but Marquez did wrap up the constructors' title for Honda, so they got that. And he is pretty much single-handedly probably going to win them the teams' championship, although Ducati still leads that one right now, I believe. Right, Derek? I think so.
Yeah.
That is pretty much how the race ended up. Again, Marquez did run out of fuel on the cooldown lap, and he was helped back to the pits by one Hafisaari, which led people to speculate the fact that, hey, you have to take a fuel sample from a motorcycle, and if there's no fuel in the motorcycle, how do you get a fuel sample? So how do we know that Marquez and his team didn't cheat with a different type of fuel? Well, that was answered by Matt Oxley in his article on Motorsports Magazine, which says that they only really need about 20 milliliters to do all the sampling tests that are required for them to do. And by the time the bike got back to the pits in Two Park Fermé, the fuel bladder that's in there to keep the fuel from sloshing around will let the fuel drain out, plus what's on in the fuel line running to the injectors gives you about that 20 milliliters. So there was enough fuel for them to do the testing. So that's how they actually got through that one. But that's basically everything from Japan for MotoGP, unless you've got something you want to add into it.
No, I mean, that's pretty much it. Bit of a snoozer, solid, scrap between Dovi and Vinales, but yeah. Other than that sums up the weekend. Yeah. And it sucks when the race is for third, you know?
Yeah.
It's still good. I'm glad they covered it. You know, sometimes you don't get to see all the good battles, but yeah, that wraps up Japan.
I got to add one thing. So Marquez winning the race gives him 54 Premier Class victories, which puts him dead even with Mick Doohan, with a chance to win in Phillip Island and surpass Doohan in Australia, which is interesting. So you have that little tidbit I'll add there as a Mark Marquez record book. I see this man continues to destroy the record book, or at least rewrite it.
I think race wins and all that stuff is kind of silly at this point, though, because, I mean, how many races a season did Doohan have? 13?
12? Yeah. You, by percentage, you have so many more races.
Yeah.
Yes,
I agree. At Agostini's record and how many classes, it's so arbitrary at this point.
It is.
It's like,
it is. But they like to make a big deal out of it, and I thought I'd just throw it in there. But to me, the more impressive statistic for Mark Marquez is the fact that he has finished first or second in every race except for Austin. Yeah. That yeah, is podium percentages. Amazing. He's got a 50% strike rate on podiums. Or sorry, he's got a 50% strike rate for poles, and he's got like a 65 or 75. No, he's got like an 85% strike rate for podiums, which is incredible. I mean, that's consistency beyond like Wayne Rainey consistency. I mean, that's just phenomenal. So, but you know, there's not enough superlatives left for what Marquez can do. And quite honestly, I just enjoy watching the kid ride because it's just amazing. He's actually said now that he sees all the, you know, he developed his elbow style when he was on 125s, and he kind of really honed it on Moto 2 because it was a way to ride around the chatter that existed in the Moto 2 frame that he had. And he says now, you know, he just kind of translated that elbow down style to help save the front when it was chattering. So he just moved it from Moto 2, moved it to Moto GP. And now he says he watches all the young kids in the CEV, and he says next thing you know, they're going to be using their shoulders within a couple of years. So that would be really wild to see. Well, that.
Soon we're going to have the Scott Redding head down. That's what that's my prediction.
There you go.
Head down.
Yep, gotta have that's to have a new slider on the side of your helmet.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I think that does it for the show. We are definitely done. We're like Derek said early on in the show, we are going to wait until after the race in Malaysia, and we will do Phillip Island and Malaysia review of the show, and then we'll have that 2 week break, I think, before we have the final round in Valencia. Things to look for in Australia: Remy Gardner winning if it's wet, Della Porta with the potential of wrapping up the race, and we'll have to see how Alex Marquez does in the Moto 2 race. If you want to get in touch with us, leave us some feedback, you can do that by emailing us at motopod@motopodcast.com. All the hosts are out on social media. I'm RGV on Instagram and Twitter. Derek, you're on Instagram and Twitter as Derek Moto C. And if you want to find all the rest of the guys out there, you can. Everybody was willing to chat with you as it is. But that will do it. Hopefully you will enjoy it. So again, Derek and I will be back in 2 weeks, and we'll talk about Malaysia and Phillip Island. Goodbye.